Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
When we left off, Marina and Lee had finally received all of the necessary approvals from the U.S. and Soviet governments for both of them to travel to America. We'll return to the details of Marina and Lee's trip to the U.S., which included their infant daughter June, who was born in February of 1962. But first, we're going to go back and tie a bow on a few loose ends related to Oswald's time in the Soviet Union. We'll try to answer some potentially important questions, like, was Oswald's historic diary authentic? Did he speak any Russian while he was in the Soviet Union? Did Oswald ever follow through on his promise to provide secrets to the Soviets? What can we learn from the back and forth between the State Department Office of Security and the CIA when it comes to false defectors to the Soviet Union? And the big question, was Lee Harvey Oswald a false defector on behalf of American intelligence agencies?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
I'm working on
this is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. When we talk about Lee Harvey Oswald's time in the Soviet Union, one of the cornerstones of our understanding of what was going on in his life is his written diary. This document has come to be known as Oswald's historic diary. But as we've mentioned already, there are several instances of the diary being in direct conflict with other credible records. Here are a few of the most notable conflicts. On the day of Oswald's alleged suicide attempt, the diary says that Rima Shirakova arrived at the hotel to pick him up at 8 o'clock, but Shirakova says that it was closer to 2:30. The doctors at the hospital say that Oswald arrived at 4 o'clock. The diary says that Lee stayed at the Hotel Metropole for all of December, but the American Embassy in Moscow report to the State Department says that Oswald checked out of the hotel in early December. The diary has multiple entries for the 11 days when Oswald is in the hospital when he got his tonsils taken out in Minsk, but somehow he does not mention being in the hospital once. There are numerous other small discrepancies, like, for example, the diary saying that Oswald's travel visa was good for 5 days when it was really good for 6 days. The diary saying Oswald was told by the Soviets that he couldn't stay in the Soviet Union when, in reality, it was Rima Shirakova who told him this. The November 1st, 1959 diary entry that says Oswald received 3 phone calls from his brother and mother, but in reality, Marguerite and Robert actually called Lee 2 weeks later, not on November 1st. The Warren Report hypothesized that Oswald began writing this diary while he was in Minsk, and that the entries from before Minsk were all written at the same time. If that's true, it could potentially explain some of the discrepancies before Minsk, but that would also mean that the diary is basically unreliable before Minsk. These discrepancies with the diary beg the question of how exactly did we come into possession of Oswald's historic diary? The diary was first published in Life magazine on July 10, 1964. Life obtained a copy from news reporter Hugh Ainsworth, who refused to say exactly how he got the diary pages. We know that the diary was not recovered from Ruth Payne's house or from Oswald's rooming house because the document wasn't found, initialed, photographed, or inventoried by the Dallas police detectives. But somehow, Hugh Ainsworth found it. On top of the inconsistencies with the diary itself, Warren Report critics point to potential ties between Hugh Ainsworth and the CIA to suggest that we can't rely on the diary at all. Ainsworth admitted that J. Walton Moore from the CIA Dallas office did contact him about providing information on Cuba when he was there. But Ainsworth denies ever working with the CIA or being paid in any way. The FBI investigated how exactly Ainsworth found the diary, and they concluded that Assistant District Attorney Bill Alexander gave it to him. This was partially because Alexander shared the payout with Ainsworth when he sold the diary for 5 figures, which was a very large sum at the time. The handwriting experts on the House Select Committee on Assassinations also looked at the historic diary. They were only able to look at one page, July 15, 1961 through January 4, 1962, because the other pages were too badly stained with fingerprint developer. The handwriting experts generally found that the historic diary was consistent with at least some other documents written by Oswald. But they also determined that the diary was likely written in one sitting and was not a recording of Oswald's activities as he was doing them. But remember, there's no evidence of the diary in the list of items that was retrieved by the Dallas police when they thoroughly searched the Payne house and Oswald's rooming house. So, for me at least, Oswald's historic diary remains a mystery. The question of how good Lee Harvey Oswald's Russian was is much debated. In a previous episode, we talked about Oswald passing a Russian language test in the Marines and impressing Rosaline Quinn with his Russian language skills. There are a lot of witnesses who say that Oswald didn't speak any Russian at all when he was in the Soviet Union. For example, when Oswald was in the hospital in Moscow after the attempted suicide, all discussions with Oswald at the Botkinskaya Hospital were in Russian. The doctors wrote, quote, "The patient apparently understands the questions asked in Russian. Sometimes he answers correctly, but immediately states that he does not understand what was asked." In 1998, researcher John Armstrong interviewed Anna Evelina Zeiger, one of the daughters of Oswald's boss at the factory in Minsk. Zeiger said that Oswald did not speak any Russian at all in Minsk. Her father would interpret for the rest of the family anytime Oswald spoke. And remember, Oswald was visiting the Zeigers 3 or 4 nights a week, so Anna would definitely know whether or not he spoke Russian. She says he never spoke Russian once in their house. When Oswald was in Minsk, he dated only English-speaking Russian girls and befriended only English-speaking guys. If it's true that Oswald really didn't even try to speak any Russian while he was in the Soviet Union, perhaps one reason may have been that he was worried that if his Russian was perceived as being too good, then he may be suspected of being a spy, whether or not he actually was one. When Oswald met Marina and got to know her well enough to ask her to marry him, and for her to agree, they would have needed a common language to communicate. But the Warren Report tells us that Marina didn't speak English, and most people in the USSR said that Lee didn't speak Russian while he was there. On the other hand, Robert Webster said that Marina spoke English to him. Marina wrote in both English and Russian on the back of photos that were taken in Minsk. On October 22, 1961, Lee wrote a letter to Marina from Minsk when she was in Kharkov. This letter was entirely in English. We also know from Marina's notebooks, such as Commission Exhibit 110, that Marina had near-perfect English handwriting, at least in 1963. According to Robert Oswald's interview with FBI agent Bardwell Odom, Marina spoke English to Robert. Robert said that shortly after the assassination in December of 1963, he and Marina went away from the group to discuss the terms of a legal contract that had been offered to Marina by her business manager, James Martin. This conversation between Robert Oswald and Marina Oswald about various terms of a contract was exclusively in English. James Martin, her business manager, for his part, told the HSCA that Marina could understand English quite well and she could always make herself understood when she wanted to. When she didn't want to answer a question or didn't understand it, she didn't. Still, Marina insisted on having an interpreter present each time that she spoke to the police, the Secret Service, the FBI, or the Warren Commission, and she spoke no English on any of those occasions. As we've discussed, Oswald threatened to provide military secrets to the Soviets when he spoke to Richard Snyder and John McVicker at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Did Oswald even have access to valuable military secrets? And if so, did Oswald follow through with his threat of sharing secrets with the Soviets? Lieutenant John Donovan told the Warren Commission that when they found out Oswald was in Moscow in mid-December, the Marine Corps, quote, changed aircraft call signs, codes, radio frequencies, and radar frequencies because he had access to the location of all bases in the West Coast area, all radio frequencies for all squadrons, all tactical call signs, and the relative strength of all squadrons, number and type of aircraft in a squadron, who was the commanding officer, and the authentication code of entering and exiting the air defense identification zone. He knew the range of our radio and the surrounding units' radio and radar. Donovan's statement is consistent with the memos that were sent from the U.S. Embassy in Moscow to the Office of Naval Intelligence concerning Oswald's intent. We know that Naval Intelligence received the information because they wrote back requesting to be kept in the loop. Given Lieutenant Donovan's statement to the Warren Commission, it's safe to say that Oswald did have access to some secrets, and that what he knew was important enough for the Marine Corps to take action to change information up that Oswald would have known about. But whether he actually provided that secret information is not known. When Oswald was trying to get his passport so that he could return to the States, He told the U.S. Embassy in 1962 that he had not followed through on his threat to share secrets with the Soviets. That's just what Oswald was saying. Who knows if it's true? Also, according to KGB agent turned CIA asset Yuri Nosenko, Oswald was kept under constant surveillance by Soviet intelligence, but they viewed him as mentally unfit. Nosenko told Gerald Posner, quote, KGB was not interested. I cannot emphasize that enough. Nosenko said that the KGB didn't care that Oswald was in the Marines, quote, first, he wasn't in the Marines any longer. Even if he had come to us in uniform, we still would have had no interest. What was he in the Marine Corps? A major? A colonel? We had better information already coming from KGB sources than he could ever give us. In 1991, the first person to act as liaison between the CIA and the KGB, Slava Nikonov, told his CIA counterpart that Lee Harvey Oswald was never a KGB asset or agent in any way whatsoever, though he was watched closely while he was in the Soviet Union. Nikonov also shared that the KGB files revealed that Oswald was a poor shooter when he tried target practice in Minsk.
Hey everybody, Matt Crumpton here. When I'm not researching, writing, or recording, one of my favorite ways to relax is with federally legal THC from Mood.com. This stuff doesn't come from a lab. It's pesticide-free and grown on American farms. You can get 20% off your first order using the code JFK. One of my go-tos is the functional gummies from Mood.com. These gummies only take 15 minutes to feel the effects, and you can choose all kinds of different moods, from creativity to pain relief to just plain old relaxation. Everything comes right to your door and is discreetly labeled. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you also get 20% off of your first order using code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Remember, use code JFK for a 20% discount.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to Ramp.com and love finance again.
In October of 1960, Otto Otepka, the head of the State Department's Office of Security, found out that 18 U.S. citizens had recently defected to the Soviet Union. This was an unprecedented spike in Soviet defections, and Otepka wanted to know what was going on. He assumed that some of these defections probably resulted from false defectors working with the CIA or military intelligence. Otepka was trying to avoid taking any adverse actions to disrupt the missions of those potential false defectors. To do that, he needed to know who the false defectors were. Otepka informally asked the CIA for a list of false defectors, but he didn't get an answer. His concerns were formally raised on October 25, 1960, in a letter from Hugh Cumming of the State Department's Intelligence and Research Bureau to CIA Deputy Director of Plans, Richard Bissell. The letter requested detailed information on these 18 defectors, and Lee Harvey Oswald was on the list. Richard Bissell, the recipient of this letter at the CIA, is the same guy that James Angleton's deputy, Ray Rocha, cryptically implied to the HSCA may have had contact with Oswald. Bissell turned the request regarding the 18 defectors over to Angleton's Counterintelligence Division and Sheffield Edwards' CIA Office of Security. In a surprising move, Bissell did not involve the Soviet Russia Division, even though they're the ones who had jurisdiction over an issue dealing with Soviet defectors. Why would the Soviet Russia Division of the CIA not be kept in the loop on this interagency request about American defectors to the Soviet Union? The research project was then turned over to Robert Bannerman, who was Sheffield Edwards' deputy. Bannerman gave it to the security research staff within the Department of Security, led by Paul Gaynor. Gaynor then assigned the actual work to staffer Marguerite Stevens. But her assignment was worded in a strange way. Stevens was told to look up information on these 18 defectors that were requested by the State Department, but there was this caveat. Quote, other than Vernon F. Mitchell and William H. Martin, and five other defectors whom Mr. Otepka of the State Department already has information on in his files, Lee Harvey Oswald was one of those five people on the list that Marguerite Stevens was told to avoid in her research. I couldn't find any evidence that Otepka had in fact already been given information on Mitchell, Martin, or any of the five other defectors. That narrative appears to be a cover story that was designed to make sure that the CIA did not provide answers on the seven defectors who Stevens was told to avoid researching. We don't know for sure that those seven people were definitely false defectors, but why else would their identities be surreptitiously taken out of this research project under what looks like false pretenses? Eventually, the CIA sent a full response to the State Department, apparently without researching seven of the 18 names. Oswald was number 10 on the list, and there was a notation next to his name that said, secret. For what it's worth, there are seven people who were marked secret, two who were marked confidential, one of them was Robert Webster, and seven who were marked unclassified. There were two others who were not included at all. So, to recap, Otepka knew that the false defector number seemed a little bit too high to be realistic, and given that the Soviets have false defectors coming to America, he thought the CIA likely had false defectors that were going to the Soviet Union. It was, after all, the peak of the Cold War. When Otepka asked the CIA for information, they bypass the Soviet Russia Division and go to the Office of Security and Counterintelligence for some reason. Then, the person there who finally does the research project is told to not look at Oswald's records, among other people. It seems like the CIA is hiding something related to these seven people on the list, including Oswald. After the CIA responded to Otepka's inquiry about the 18 defectors, his career took a negative turn. In 1958, Otepka was awarded a Meritorious Service Award for his work leading the Office of Security by Secretary of State John Foster Dulles. The award was given for detail, loyalty, devotion to duty, and sound judgment. After Otepka requested the defector files from the CIA, he found that his access to sensitive cases was suddenly limited. He was asked to transfer to another division within the State Department, but he refused. Otepka found hidden listening devices in his office that had never been there before. He was also assigned to work closely with former NSA employee David Belial. One night, when Otepka was working late and returned to his office after going to dinner, he found David Belial and an NSA employee in his office without a good reason to be there. Otepka noticed that his safe had been drilled into and someone had stolen the only material in the safe, which was Otepka's study of these 18 American defectors to the Soviet Union, including Lee Harvey Oswald. It was later revealed that Otepka's boss, John Francis Riley, was the one who took his files. 3 weeks before President Kennedy was assassinated, Otepka was fired from the State Department. He later told journalist Sarah McClendon that he knew who killed President Kennedy, but then Otepka declined to comment on the record. I couldn't think of any explanation for the facts that I just laid out, other than that the CIA was trying to hide the status of some of those 18 defectors, one of them being Lee Harvey Oswald. So I went to Vincent Bugliosi's Reclaiming History and Gerald Posner's Case Closed, looking for counterpoints on the story of Otto Otepka. I was surprised to find that there's no mention at all in the indexes of either book when it comes to the name Otto Otepka. This brings us to the big question. Was Lee Harvey Oswald a false defector to the Soviet Union? So far, we have the following facts. Oswald flew into Helsinki, which was the only place he could have gotten a Soviet travel visa in 24 hours. There was a memo about using Helsinki to get to the Soviet Union quickly the day before Oswald arrived. Oswald knew that he would stay exactly 5 days in Helsinki, which is exactly how long he ended up staying. Oswald didn't have much money, but he stayed at the fanciest hotels in Helsinki, booked his entire Russian tour in the most expensive deluxe class, and stayed at Hotel Metropole in Moscow for weeks. Oswald got help from the highest level of the State Department to pressure the INS to let Marina emigrate to the United States, and the INS then changed their position. The CIA specifically did not look into Oswald's file when they were asked if he was a false defector, based on the lie to their own internal researcher Marguerite Stevens that the CIA had already provided information on Oswald to the State Department. And then the man who started the inquiry at the State Department, Otto Otepka, ends up having his safe broken into by his boss and being fired 3 weeks before the assassination. Maybe it was just a coincidence. Finally, CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton, or someone working closely with him, according to Robert Bannerman, decided not to open a 201 file on Oswald, even though the CIA was reading his mail as part of HT Lingual. There are a few more points that we haven't talked about yet that are relevant to whether Oswald was a false defector. A January 26, 1961 memo from the State Department talks about how Oswald's mom thought that he may have gone to Russia as a secret agent. The State Department immediately, quote, assured her that there was no evidence that her son had gone to the Soviet Union as a secret agent, and she should dismiss any such idea. James Batelho, who served with Oswald in Santa Ana, said that when Oswald defected to the Soviet Union, it was the talk of the base. Batelho said that he knew Oswald was really anti-Soviet just from being around him. He told Mark Lane, quote, I knew then what I know now. Oswald was on assignment in Russia for American intelligence. In 1978, former CIA officer Victor Marchetti told the HSCA that the Office of Naval Intelligence had an operation that was actively attempting to place false defectors in the Soviet Union as spies. Marchetti says that the project was run out of Nag's Head, North Carolina, and he would be in a position to know, as the former special assistant to the deputy director of the CIA. If what Marchetti says is true, then that statement, combined with the request for information about false defectors from Otto Otepka, confirms that a Soviet false defector program was real. In addition to Marchetti, James Wilcott, who worked as a CIA finance officer from 1957 to 1966, told the HSCA that he had disbursed money for the Oswald Project in the late 1950s. He said that Lee Harvey Oswald was a double agent sent to the Soviet Union to do intelligence work and that his defection was phony. Wilcott's information came from CIA personnel that he worked with who were certain that Oswald was an agent of the CIA. Though Wilcott did pass the stress analysis test that was conducted by the HSCA, his testimony about Oswald is not a slam dunk because he's talking about what other people told him as opposed to his personal knowledge. Also, the HSCA in their final report concluded that they did not find Wilcott's testimony to be credible because other CIA employees who were based in the Soviet post abroad all said that Oswald was not affiliated with the CIA. Remember, Oswald's files skipped the Soviet Russia division within the CIA. We know that the Soviet Russia division was not kept in the loop for the 201 file or for the Otto Otepka project to identify false defectors. In conclusion, all of the reasons I cited earlier, plus the two CIA whistleblowers, Marchetti and Wilcott, make it more likely than not, in my view, that Lee Harvey Oswald was a false defector to the Soviet Union with ties to the Central Intelligence Agency. Next time on Solving JFK, we'll have a recap and rebuttals episode on Oswald's time in Russia. Then we move on to Lee, Marina, and June's return to the United States, including the introduction of some very important characters in Oswald's life, like George de Morenschild and Ruth Payne. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.